Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This is Carrie Weber, Associate Editor for America Magazine, and I am here with the retired Bishop, Luis del Castillo, and he is here to talk a little bit about the church in Uruguay. Now, could you tell me a little bit about what the state of the church is like there? It's a very secular country, I understand.
Possibly the most secular country in Latin America. What is now more visible in parts of Europe and perhaps also in the States started in Uruguay more than a century ago with the separation of church and state. There is a discussion today about crosses in buildings in Europe. Well, we haven't had crosses in any building since early 20th century. And there is no official presence of the church in any official or state organization. We don't have army chaplains or police chaplains or hospital chaplains or prison chaplains. In order to establish some type of ministry in those areas, we go in just like any other private person. So we have experienced this separation, especially through totally secular education on the lines of what started in the States also in the mid-19th century, but a bit exaggerated, because Horace Mann spoke of not godless education, but non-denominational. And our reformer used exactly the same terms. But still, our education has tended to be more atheistic, although that was not the initial intention. So God is, by large, the absent person in our education. Now, this at the same time has other benefits. The culture in Uruguay allows for the church to have only the prestige of its moral authority. And also, being just one among many, ecumenical and interreligious dialogue in Uruguay is very easy. That doesn't mean that everybody participates in this dialogue, but the climate favors good relationships and joint activities on the part of Christian churches, or also with Jews and the few Muslims that we have in Uruguay.
That's fascinating, to have such a positive outlook on that relationship between church and state. Now, you mentioned that this has been going on for a while there. What would you say are some of the challenges that it poses? You mentioned that you have to go in as private individuals, and you mentioned some of the positive sides, but what is the effect of this relationship on the morale of Catholics there, I guess?
Well, I think that on the part of any Catholic, we still listen to Jesus' calling to be fishers of men. But the difference with the early apostles is that we can't use nets. We have to use a line. And fishing with a line has its requirements. It's one-on-one, and it requires a lot of patience, and you have to wait for the fish's response. So our evangelizing efforts rely heavily on catechesis, especially adult catechesis. We have a limited number of ministers, both priests and religious, and many of our parishes, well, many, a percentage of our parishes are run by permanent deacons and sisters, religious. For instance, in the diocese where I was, four of the parishes are in this situation. In the case of the permanent deacon, being a team, husband and wife, the wife is a catechist, an adult catechist, and the parish has obviously a very family atmosphere. They join other families in the parish, and the families in the parish understand that the parish is their own. the rectory is not out of bounds, but it's another family where you go in and out. And that happens in many of the parishes, even with priests. The climate and the relationship in parish ministry is quite different to what I experience in the States. And in the case of religious, in areas where the priest is only present once a month, the sisters prepare baptisms and preside at the ceremony, and also prepare marriages and can bless the marriages, except that this sacrament is not as accepted in their hands as baptisms. People still prefer either a permanent deacon or a priest to bless their marriages.
That seems like it's really empowering the lay people and the sisters there. What do you think the church in the U.S. can learn from that model?
Well, I think that the idea would be to have future priests and religious spend at least a year in a rural parish in the areas from which we receive immigrants in this country, not just to translate into hesitant Spanish an American style of ministry, but to actually change the style of ministry to adapt to the immigrants.
And what type of changes would be involved in that?
Well, the difference has to do with a sort of office or enterprise atmosphere or a totally informal family atmosphere where the priest is part of the family and the relationship of every parish member to the rectory and to the parish buildings is of belonging, and the parish is people's own. It's not something that you go to, like to a theater for a performance, but it's like a member of the family's house or home. It's more homely.
Now, does the church in Uruguay rally, I guess, behind causes such as environmental causes or political causes in the way that you might see some of the bishops here rallying for or against some of the causes in our political culture here in the U.S.?
There are obviously points in common, issues that are very clear in the universal church, the church wherever it is. But the relationship with the political issues in the country is somewhat different to that of other Latin American countries where church and state have been united until recently, and there is still a strong relationship. In our case, the Catholic Church is the most respected institution in the private sector, but has only its moral authority to speak up on any issue.
Has word of the sex abuse scandal reached Uruguay in a way that has affected the church's moral authority there?
Certainly not to the extent in other countries. We haven't had any significant child abuse cases in the last years. That doesn't mean that there haven't been different types of sins on the part of the clergy, but it hasn't made the headlines on a national basis, although the international crisis or scandal has made the headlines as often as in the rest of the world.
And has that changed the views of the people in the church there in that country?
Not greatly, in the sense that because of this very early separation at the beginning of the 20th century, 100 years ago, the criticism of the church has been ongoing and very acid. And obviously what is worth criticism has always been criticized. So it's no news.
And so what do you see as the direction of the church in Uruguay going forward? What ways do you think that the church will grow there?
Well, I think what we expressed in relation to how the ministry develops, there is going to be more and more empowerment of the laity to evangelize. The slogan would be everybody evangelizing everybody all the time. In other words, mission and ministry is part of the baptism commitment for everybody, not just a few active members of the community.
Are there many priestly vocations coming from Uruguay, or are most of the priests in that area coming from other countries?
We don't have many vocations, but the majority of the clergy is still Uruguayan. In other words, we have to handle the evangelizing effort with few people, but that precisely helps to rely more on everybody's activity, especially lay catechists for every age, for children and for grown-ups.
Let's talk about the biggest challenges that you see facing the church. There's the ministerial challenges. Are there other ways that you see the church having other problems or having to overcome challenges in the years ahead?
I think that we have to be more open and active, proactive, in those areas where our presence is, on one hand, more needed by the country in general, and more accepted as well, as in social work in the more deprived areas, education, and ethical formation at every level. The perception that Transparency International has about Uruguay is that it's one of the less corrupt countries in Latin America. But still, it's something to worry about, looking at all the examples we have all over the place. So I think one of the challenges is to strongly develop gospel-inspired activity in favor of the well-being of the population in general, which means dialogue with local culture and strengthening our presence inspired in the gospel in those areas.
Now, Uruguay has a very high literacy rate, is that correct? I imagine that must be helpful in your ministry and in educating people about the faith.
It means that we can distribute literature and everybody reads it, which is not the case in countries where you have 35 to 50% illiteracy rate. The difficulty today is that secondary education isn't doing as well as elementary education because there's a very high percentage of dropouts, and that means that even our totally free university, you can get a degree for free, is not accessible for a strong percentage of our citizens, our young people, because they don't finish secondary education. So the society in general and the government in particular in Uruguay are looking for a significant educational reform that will permit the relationship between secondary education and college education, secondary education and the skills for whatever work is offered in the country can improve in the next years. And in this process, the church, with a very large presence in both parochial schools and university that started 25 years ago, has a responsibility and a possibility that is accepted by the government in the sense that our educational and social efforts are not from the top down, but through the presence of volunteers at grassroots. So it's from the bottom up. It's a presence, an active presence, that is far more cost effective. and also reaches where it has to reach on a permanent and sustainable basis, much more than many top-to-bottom programs. Trickle-up here is much better than trickle-down.
So tell me a little bit about what you're doing here in New York.
Well, I had a responsibility in the Bishops' Conference until May, and since I have been here doing research on one side and now teaching at Fordham University, the Graduate School of Education, because a very well-known Jesuit, Father Charlie Byrne, passed away a few weeks ago. And the dean asked me to replace him in a seminar for students that are starting their doctoral studies. So that's what I will be doing until mid-October.
That seems like quite the change of pace for you, maybe?
Well, I've always been involved in education. Mm-hmm. I started right after theological studies, after ordination, as principal of a huge school the Jesuits have in Montevideo, 2,000 students. Then, after time as novice director, I helped start the first private university in the country, breaking the state monopoly. Until 1985, there was just one large state university in Montevideo. I was president of this Catholic university, more or less on the lines of the Catholic University of America in Washington. It's the Bishops' Conference University, but entrusted to the Jesuits. Then I was appointed Auxiliary Bishop of Montevideo. I spent some time as rector of the Interdiocesan Seminary. And then I was appointed Bishop of Melo, which is a diocese right on the border with Brazil, a rural area, cattle raising and rice paddies. So that's more or less my relationship to education. In this diocese, the bishop was directly responsible for 5 elementary schools and 2 high schools.
What was it like to start that university? It must have been sort of a huge challenge, but also pretty kind of invigorating.
Well, we started as normally all these initiatives start, with no building, no seed money, just a few students. We had 400 the first year. The university today, 25 years later, has more than 8,000. It has grown not only in numbers but in quality. Obviously, with the opposition of the state university, because we were breaking the monopoly, the Uruguayan intelligentsia, because they didn't want the influence of a foreign power, namely the Vatican, training our young people, and part of the church that preferred a lower profile. But, well, I think we managed to overcome those difficulties and challenges.
Now, have you noticed a big difference between teaching and, you know, working in education in Uruguay and working in education and teaching in the U.S., in New York especially?
Well, I can only speak of one 4-hour class so far.
You're very new.
Yes.
What do you miss about Uruguay?
Well, not much, because I'm very concentrated in what I'm doing here, and living in a Jesuit community varies not too much from one country to another.
Well, that makes sense, kind of a brotherhood in every place that you go. Is there anything else that you want to mention about your work there or the country in general that we haven't touched on?
No, I think that there are a number of relationships that the church in Uruguay has had with the church in the States, and the Jesuits in Uruguay with the Jesuits in the States, that have been very fruitful. In fact, 3 California Jesuit universities, USF, University of San Francisco, Santa Clara, and Loyola Marymount, plus the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, helped us develop the first MBA ever in Uruguay. And they formed a consortium to help that. And both the California province and the New York province of the Jesuits have been very supportive of our efforts, especially in education. There is also a relationship that maybe not everybody is aware of. President Kennedy started two programs to relate United States with Latin America. One was state to state, called the Alliance for Progress, that practically ended with President Kennedy. The other one was private sector to private sector, called Partners of the Americas, and this is still in operation. Each American state has a Latin American partner. Our partner is the state of Minnesota, perhaps because there's a small town called Montevideo, or rather Montevideo, in Minnesota.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and talk with me. I really appreciate it. It was lovely having you here.
Well, my pleasure.